It's Central Time. I'm Rob Farage. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, a Wisconsin business expert looks into the future of in-person retail shopping and why it's not dying, just taking on a new form. First, the Biden administration put in place a new ban on evictions yesterday after a previous ban expired last weekend. The latest version is more limited. It bans evictions in counties with substantial or high transmission of the coronavirus through October 3rd. But President Biden says he expects to see the latest moratorium challenged in court, and he's expressed some doubts about whether the move would be considered constitutional. It's the week in Washington. We'll talk about that, the bipartisan infrastructure deal, and more. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. Did you want to see this eviction moratorium extended, or at least partly extended? Are you worried that the Biden administration may be acting unconstitutionally? Do you think the government should stop ending evictions right now at this point? And if you're close to this story, a landlord yourself, a renter, someone who's gone through eviction, love to hear your thoughts on this at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can email ideas@WPR.org. Scott Wong is a senior reporter at The Hill. Scott, welcome back to the show.
Hey, Rob. Good to be back with you.
You've been watching this eviction moratorium. A lot of drama within Democratic ranks in Congress and the White House. What did we see leading up to this announcement from the White House?
Well, we saw a lot of finger-pointing among Democrats, namely from the White House to Capitol Hill and Capitol Hill back to the Biden administration. Lawmakers, Democratic lawmakers, including Nancy Pelosi, along with a number of progressive Democrats, didn't appreciate Biden sort of dropping this in their lap 2 days before this moratorium was set to expire. That would be last Saturday. The Biden administration said Congress needs to figure out a way to pass legislation to extend the moratorium that had been with us for a good part of this pandemic. That happened just as Congress was, the House specifically, was about to leave for their long summer recess. So this was sort of a last minute thing. Pelosi gathered her lieutenants, huddled with Democrats. They thought about passing some legislation on the final day that they were going to be in session before that break, and decided that they could not do so. They could not come together to agree on something so quickly. Plus, there's the calculation that Senate Republicans would go ahead and block whatever House Democrats passed on the other side of the chamber. And so there was a lot of frustration, a lot of finger pointing. And ultimately, Pelosi gave an ultimatum to Joe Biden and the White House and said, look, we're leaving town. You guys need to figure out how to deal with this. This is going to be a huge crisis. And you guys need to unilaterally do something to extend the moratorium or create a new moratorium. And that's exactly what Joe Biden did.
White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki was asked about why the administration thinks it has the power to do this after some in the administration said it didn't have the power to do this. Here's what she said at a press briefing today.
What was announced yesterday was not an extension of the existing moratorium, which was, of course, national. It was a more limited moratorium that was going to be impacting and helping areas that were hardest hit by COVID.
Can you talk us through what this new moratorium, a partial moratorium, is, Scott?
Yeah, it's essentially a two-month new moratorium on evicting people from their apartments and homes, renters, who are unable to pay for their rent due to, you know, things that they're dealing with the pandemic, including job losses. It is more limited than the previous moratorium, but Chuck Schumer, the Senate Majority Leader, said it would probably cover about 90% of the country. So almost everyone. The issue that Biden has referenced in his press conference yesterday was whether or not the Biden administration has the legal authority to do so, because the previous moratorium was struck down by the courts and ruled unconstitutional. And that decision was basically supported by the Supreme Court, which decided to allow the lower level courts to rule on that issue. And so Biden has raise concerns about the legality of this new moratorium. But in the meantime, while this will work its way through the courts, Democrats and the White House believe this will buy people more time to stay in their homes to prevent sort of a mass eviction of renters. And that should allow, Democrats hope, more of this $47 billion of rental assistance, rental aid that was already approved by Congress to get to the people who need it most. Out of that $47 billion, only $3 billion has been spent so far. And so there's enormous red tape that's preventing the money from getting into the hands of people who need it. And that's sort of what the hangup is with this housing crisis, getting the money into the hands of people who need it so that they can pay their rent and pay their landlords.
Talking to Scott Wong from The Hill, looking at the top stories in national politics, including right now a new partial moratorium on evictions. You can join in with your thoughts on that at 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Bill is with us in Upton. Bill, hi.
Good morning. How you doing?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Bill?
Well, I agree with this person that's on the air with you that the Supreme Court already ruled on it. And I don't think the president or the administration has any grounds to stand on, in my opinion.
Bill, thanks for the call. And Scott, this is almost certainly going to be this new moratorium, almost certainly going to be tested in the courts, right?
Yeah, it almost certainly will, because you have thousands upon thousands of landlords, some of them not necessarily, you know, big corporations. Some of them are small landlords, people who own homes or apartments that are renting them out, and that's their livelihood. And if those people are not getting paid, there's a real concern from these landlords that they will have to file for bankruptcy of some sort. And so you could sort of see both sides of this equation. Look, nobody wants to be in this situation. It has been caused by a pandemic that we're all dealing with and have been dealing with for more than a year now. But the Biden people believe that this hopefully will buy them enough time to, now this $47 billion is already in state and local coffers. So that money's out the door. It's out of Washington. It's in states and cities. And now the challenge is figuring out how to get it to the people who need it most. There's a lot of just red tape and paperwork that people have been struggling to work through in order to apply for these funds. There's a lot of federal requirements. And so the charge from the president and from the Congress has been to make sure we prioritize, make sure the money is getting to the right people so that they can stay in their homes, not be put out on the streets, and that landlords also can get paid.
Is there any thought that Congress is going to go back and tackle this, I don't know, after a recess or something, or are they off the hook now with this moratorium?
Well, let's see what happens here. I mean, the reason why this got done this week is largely should be credited to a progressive freshman lawmaker named Cori Bush from Missouri. She, after Congress had gone home and sort of punted the issue back to the White House, Cori Bush decided to camp out on the steps of the Capitol for four straight nights protesting the inaction in Washington. She was joined by other leaders like Bernie Sanders and AOC. Chuck Schumer even dropped by to show his support for her cause. And it really galvanized Democrats and put enormous pressure on the White House, which ultimately did lead to this new moratorium. And so I think now this issue is front and center. If before it had been sort of on the back burner and not on the front pages of the newspapers and on the evening news, certainly it has caught everyone's attention and now is a top priority of the White House and lawmakers on Capitol Hill. And now there are, you know, national advocates who are keeping a close eye on this issue, including Cori Bush.
We're talking to Scott Wong, senior reporter for The Hill. He's with us today for our weekly look at some of the top stories in Washington. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts on this partially extended slash new moratorium on evictions from the White House, plus the never-ending story so far of infrastructure in Congress. Do you want to see something happen? Do you think something will happen? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our look at the top stories in national politics. Scott Wong is with us from The Hill. We'll move on to some other issues in a bit, but first let's hear from some of you on the moratorium on evictions. Billy is with us now in Madison. Billy, hi.
Hi. You know, I think the problem is the system is broken. Everybody cares about the voter base. So you have someone that owns, let's say, 1,000 units, okay? One person, two people own 1,000 units. There's 1,100, 1,200 people that live there. Now, that's their voter base. They want to take care of those tenants. Tell them they don't have to pay rent. We'll take care of you. Well, they only get a couple votes from that landlord, but they're getting 1,100, 1,200 votes from those tenants. I said, so that's what they're looking after here, the voter base. And that's all they care about.
Billy, thanks for the call. Scott, Billy perceives more interest on the side of the tenants, greater in number than the landlords. Has this been a concern in the debate over whether we should have this moratorium in the first place?
Well, I think the caller brings up a good point. I mean, you know, depending on the lawmaker, you know, they either could represent more tenants or they could side with the landlords. And you know, we sort of saw this week that some moderate Democrats who may be closely aligned with landlords from sort of conservative, you know, purplish districts, they were hesitant to extend the moratorium. And we saw that fight sort of playing out in the waning days before the House left for their recess. It was ultimately one of the drivers of why we did not see House Democrats take action legislatively to extend the moratorium, simply because there were moderates that are facing tough elections that perhaps received donations from a lot of landlord type constituents that are pro-business, who were reluctant to take that step and support a more long-term moratorium. And so, you know, you're seeing both sides of this issue, the landlord side and the tenant side, playing out and being represented by lawmakers in Congress.
Thanks for that call, Billy. We'll go to Dan now in Eau Claire. Dan, hi.
Hi, everybody. How you doing?
Good. What'd you want to bring up, Dan?
I have an idea of a plan that I think or something that could work. I guess I didn't realize that the money is out of federal government's hands, but even if it's at the states, why don't they just look at income tax returns from people from 2020, maybe 2021, but they're not out yet, and identify those who are low income. That's easy to do. And if they receive benefits from unemployment, that's easy to do. And there's many people out there who did not get this extra $600 a week, which, you know, is a lot of money when you add it up. There's a lot of people who had to quit jobs, had unsafe jobs, had jobs that they didn't feel were safe in the pandemic. Those people are left out in the cold and get nothing. Not everyone collected a bunch of unemployment compensation like a lot of conservative people tell them to, you know, go get a job. That just didn't happen.
Dan, thanks a lot for the call. Scott, the concern now is streamlining those payments you mentioned earlier that are from the federal government in state and local hands, getting it to the people Dan's talking about who need it the most. Is that going to look different in every state, maybe every community?
I think so. And I think part of the challenge, if you think about, you know, the amount of money we're talking about, $47 billion was just dropped in the lap of states and counties and cities. And, you know, without a lot of guidance from the federal government. And I think a lot of these states and localities were not prepared to deal with, you know, the amount of money, the number of people that were seeking this help. So what Treasury Secretary Yellen has said this week to House Democrats on a phone call was that they are, you know, stepping up efforts to provide support to these states and cities to help them get the money to the right people, to, you know, build awareness about the program. In many cases, there were people who were unable to pay their rent, who were simply not aware that this money was available. In other cases, it was a matter of access. People needed computers to be able to fill out these forms and were struggling to provide all of the information that was needed to complete these forms. So, you know, there were a lot of hurdles. There have been a lot of hurdles in the way of people being able to complete the process and then accessing that money. It's difficult to do when people are trying to, you know, work multiple jobs and care for children at home. And you can see how this would not have been a priority, even though we're talking about people trying to keep a roof over their heads.
Thanks a lot for that call. We're talking to Scott Wong from The Hill, looking at some top stories in national politics. Let's move now, Scott, to Ohio, to primary elections, part of special elections for open congressional seats. One among Democrats in a Democratic-leaning district, one among Republicans in a Republican-leaning district. A lot of attention on each. Let's start with that Republican one. Why are we paying so much attention to this race?
Well, we are paying a lot of attention to this race because of something that happened last week, and that was that a Trump-endorsed candidate, Susan Rice, down in Texas, was defeated by another Republican who was not endorsed by President Trump. That was in a special election to replace Ron Wright, who had passed away, unfortunately, of COVID. And so people were wondering whether this was just sort of a one-off thing or if there was a larger trend happening. And so we were watching the special election. And what happened in this case was the opposite. The Trump-endorsed candidate, Mike Carey, an energy lobbyist, came out on top of a pretty wide field. And so it's sort of unclear what the takeaway is. I think it's still really too early to tell, but we're going to be watching future special elections and other local races where Trump gets involved. Clearly, he is still the most dominant figure in Republican politics today. He's still the leader of the party, and he hasn't relinquished that. But it's going to take a little more time and a few more races to figure out if there's any larger trend happening within the Republican Party.
And another special election in Ohio watched as a battle between moderate establishment Democrats, however you want to call it, and the progressive wing of the party. What happened there?
Yeah, a little bit of an upset because you had the establishment-backed candidate, Chantel Brown, a local county councilor, defeat Nina Turner, who was a former co-chair of Bernie Sanders' presidential campaign, the progressive in that race. This was the race to replace Marsha Fudge, who became Biden's HUD secretary. And it just highlighted, you know, the longstanding battle between the establishment and the progressive wings of the party. You had a really interesting dynamic over the weekend. You saw the majority whip, James Clyburn, obviously representing the establishment, has served in Washington for decades, over the weekend stumping for Chantel Brown. Bernie Sanders, meanwhile, was across town stumping for Nina Turner. And so, you know, we saw this dynamic play out during the presidential race between Joe Biden and Bernie Sanders. Obviously, Biden, the establishment candidate, prevailed in that one. And so once again, in this particular race, you saw the establishment candidate prevail. But again, we have seen over the last couple election cycles, progressives have upset at key moments, have upset establishment candidates. In fact, one of the progressives we were discussing earlier, Cori Bush of Missouri, last year had defeated and upset the longtime congressman in St. Louis, Lacey Clay. And so that's one example where a progressive insurgent has come in and sort of stirred things up and upset the longstanding establishment candidate with a big name in politics.
I want to move on, Scott, to a sad story you've been following, a suicide, the fourth now, of a police officer who'd worked in the Capitol on January 6th. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, in fact, Rob, there were two officers who we learned about this week who took their own lives, in recent weeks. One was Gunther Hashida, who apparently took his life last week. The other took his life last month. His name was Kyle DeFreitag. And both of them were not Capitol police officers. They were DC Metro police officers who were called to assist Capitol police who were under attack at the Capitol that day on January 6th. There were dozens of Metro City police officers who helped and answered that call to protect and defend the Capitol. And as you mentioned, this is now the fourth officer who has taken his life. And it comes right after we heard from those officers who testified before the January 6th committee, really give emotional testimony about the toll, both the emotional toll, the psychological toll, as well as the physical toll that that day took on them and continues to take on them and their families. So obviously, our thoughts and prayers are with the families of these officers who defended the Capitol on that day.
In our last minute or so, Scott, are you hearing conversations about making sure that officers who responded on that traumatic day are getting support that they need now?
You know, the support, as I understand, is available to these officers. You know, I think what needs to happen now is more encouragement from the leadership, from the Congress, perhaps even the President of the United States to make clear that, you know, it's okay to ask for help, to get help. As I understand it, there is a support for these officers, you know, especially those who were there on January 6th. But, you know, sadly, I think a lot of them continue, you know, 7 months later, 8 months later to continue to deal with the after effects of what that day was on January 6th.
Scott, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob.
That's Scott Wong, senior reporter at The Hill. He was with us today for our weekly look at the top stories in national politics. And hey, if you or someone you know is struggling with issues related to suicide, there is help out there. The National Suicide Prevention Lifeline is 800-273-8255. That's 800-273-8255. Coming up after the news, malls filled with vacant storefronts, big box stores struggling to survive. What's next for in-person retail shopping? Talk with a Wisconsin business expert to learn more, and you can tell us how you shop these days. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 8 on The Morning Show, take a journey deep into the ocean, where the only light comes from bioluminescent life forms. Meet the author of Below the Edge of Darkness, tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. Now, the pandemic shook up the retail world, turning a lot of people into online or curbside shoppers and driving sales of some products way down while others were in high demand. There were a lot of question marks about the future of retail. More than a year later, we have a slightly better picture of what's happening in the retail landscape. While we survive with little to no in-person shopping for months, that doesn't mean the end for brick and mortar. Instead, our guest says what consumers want has become clearer. In-person shopping needs to offer something we can't get online, some kind of experience. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you prefer to do in-person shopping or online shopping? What kinds of things do you prefer to be in a store, to be able to browse the shelves for? Do you mix and match a little of this and that? Did your shopping habits change, you think, permanently? Do you miss malls? Call 800-642-1234. Or if you work in a retail store or fulfillment center, love to hear from you. 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Hart Posen is a professor of management and human resources at the UW-Madison School of Business and an expert on business strategy. Hart, welcome back to the show.
Rob, very good to be back, and I'll look forward to doing this in person next time we do it.
Oh, someday. Someday we'll do it, for sure.
I have a picture of you up on my screen, so you know I can get that feeling.
Cool, that's not weird. but seriously, okay, Hart, we talked through the pandemic about how retail was adapting, failing to adapt in some cases. Here we are, July, August 2021. We've got a sense of what normal-ish might look like. What lessons are we learning right now?
Well, you know, I think we've learned a few things over the last year and a half. And by we, I mean, in particular, some retailers, right? Even before the pandemic, if you walked around malls in the U.S., there had been a great shakeout going on because the malls were filled with stores that were relatively undifferentiated from one another. The malls didn't offer very much that we couldn't get online, and there was declining reason to go to these places. So well before the pandemic, retail was changing. And I think what the pandemic has done is it's clarified that what shoppers want from a retail experience is more than just sort of a self-service environment. They want an experience. They want there to be some unique element of going to a brick and mortar store that can't be achieved online. And so what we're seeing those changes in the malls right now here in Madison at Westtown over the last year at Westtown Mall, you can watch the mix of businesses in that mall change to more service oriented businesses. And you know, I think this is a good thing.
Yeah, I think sometimes, Hart, even pre-pandemic, and we've had conversations about this before, there's sometimes this notion that, okay, a big, famous, long-standing retail chain is having trouble or going out of business or whatever, and this idea that, okay, in-person retail is dying. It's going away. It's being replaced. You say, no, it's evolving, whether within a store or maybe that store goes away, but something else is picking up the slack.
That's right. You know, and so in some ways, I think the pandemic has been this great clearing out, you know, in the malls and in lots of places where lots of retailers that were not good retailers, dying retailers, were slowly dying retailers, zombie retailers. And what the pandemic has done is it has swished those away from those locations that might be good, useful retail locations and allowed firms that were better oriented towards what we want today in a shop, in-person shopping experience, to fill those slots. And so I think, you know, that it has been a great window of opportunity. So what you've seen is both that some retailers are changing what they do to provide a richer in-person experience, and some retailers are going away to be replaced by others who are incapable of doing that.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Dimitri is with us in Appleton. Dimitri, hi.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. What's your shopping story, Dimitri?
So my shopping story is, you know, I'm a pretty tall, thin guy in Appleton, Wisconsin. So it's really difficult for me to find clothing, especially online, not just in person. So I've always been a big proponent of shopping in person rather than online. I mean, in Appleton, Wisconsin, there's, you know, there's quite a limited variety of stuff, but it's tangible stuff that you can put on and feel. And, you know, you have those big box office brands that you can go to and, you know, get their size and find that stuff online. And I feel like it would be impossible for, you know, those in-person chain stores to go out of business.
Dimitri, thanks a lot for sharing that. So clothing, Hart, I know people do buy clothes online. It can be hard, especially if you need that tall, skinny guy stuff that Dimitri does to find stuff that fits. That's one case where that in-person experience may stick with us.
Well, you know, my feeling, I'm the opposite of Dimitri. He needs tall and skinny. I need short and fat. But we have the same problem, Dimitri and I. I think what's happening, what we've seen, and this started before the pandemic, is that retailers, both at, you know, originally online retailers and retailers that were originally brick and mortar have recognized that the truth of the matter is this is not that brick and mortar is going away. The truth of the matter is that brick and mortar and online are not substitutes, they're complements for one another. So it could well be that Dimitri goes into a store to feel the material, see the cut, or even try on a style, and then maybe even buy something in person, but then returns to that retailer now that he knows that this particular style or this particular cut works for him, and buys other colors and buys related styles. So these are complements, not substitutes. And so you see retailers that started as purely online retailers increasingly opening up physical spaces. And that's going to continue for sure.
Dimitri, thanks a lot for that call. We're talking to Hart Posen from the UW-Madison School of Business, looking at retail, how it's been changing pre-pandemic, during the pandemic, what the future looks like. You can join in at 800-642-1234. When do you shop online? What do you like to get in person? Does the store experience matter to you? Do you work in retail? What changes are you seeing? Call 800-642-1234. Now, Hart, you've talked about that store experience, and that conjures up in my head, you know, something really fancy, and maybe they're pouring a little champagne for you while you shop for really expensive stuff. But you say the experience doesn't have to necessarily be that high-end experience.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. By store experience, I don't mean high-end or low-end. I mean that it is an experience that you enjoy, that you seek out. I don't know about you, but I bet lots of your listeners we're Costco shoppers. Costco is not a fancy experience, but it is a unique experience, particularly now that they can bring food samples back. And we go there for that experience. Their staff is high-quality staff. The store experience is pleasant. It's enjoyable. Lots of people enjoy going. And you know, so that is not a high-end experience, but it is certainly a unique experience. And consumers will seek that out, and they are seeking that out.
Now, you mentioned zombie stores earlier. I'm kind of a holdout shopper for those, often because it's a really quiet experience. There are big crowds. I'm not going to name names for the stores I go to and insult them, but I like going to those stores because there's nobody in my way. I could just get right up to find what I want and walk right up to the counter. I don't know. Obviously, I'm rare. Otherwise, it'd be too crowded and I wouldn't go there.
I won't comment on that, Rob. I'll leave that one alone.
All right. So if I am running that store, though, where the only customer in the shop right now is Rob, what do I do? Is it possible if I'm at that state to shake my way out of it? I know stores like JCPenney's have been trying to do exactly that for, what, a decade now?
Yeah, JCPenney, Sears, and others that have gone by the wayside, you know, Pier 1, these types of folks. Look, once you are of the size of a JCPenney, this kind of change is incredibly challenging. Very few of those will survive. And, you know, that's fine. It's clearly not fine for the people that work there. Don't get me wrong. But the best thing for any community is that firms that are poor performers go away. More effective retailers take their place. These retailers, if they're more effective, will need more staff, will be growing, will create opportunities for advancement. And so I think it is a good thing. The other part of your question, Rob, I think is this question about, you know, smaller retailers, mom and pop retailers. Mm-hmm. A lot of those have been really badly hurt by the pandemic for obvious reasons. And, you know, they've responded in sort of a very different ways to the pandemic. Some have found new and interesting ways to engage with their customers, and some have not. And I hope that the pandemic was a wake-up call to them that if they are to compete, they will need to offer something unique, something different, something that we can't get elsewhere. And they're going to have to start to think, particularly if their goal is to grow beyond, you know, one or two or a handful of locations, how they can take the best of what they do, match it with an online presence that works together. And so, you know, I'm hoping it was a wake-up call, and I'm hoping we'll see lots of new ideas come out of the past year and a half of tragedy.
We're talking to Hart Posen, professor of management and human resources at the UW-Madison School of Business. We're taking a look at the future of brick and mortar retail and what makes you want to shop in person versus online. And you can answer that at 800-642-1234. Are there certain stores or kind of stores you look forward to shopping at in person during the pandemic? When you couldn't go into a store, say, was there one you were really hankering to get back into? Or did you make the shift to buying online? And if you work at or own a retail store, love to hear from you and your experience and what's changed. 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation. Maybe hear from you coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We pick up our talk now with Hart Posen from the UW-Madison School of Business, looking at the future of retail and shopping. Let's go to your calls now at 800-642-1234. Susie is on the line in New Berlin. Susie, hi.
Hi. I was glad to hear that your guest mentioned that after the tall, thin gentleman would go into the store and try things on and look at fabrics and things, that he would go home and buy from that same store. I have some friends who have a beautiful, very high quality pet shop, pet supplies, and it's in Kalamazoo now, but people would come in when they were in Hoboken, people would come in and try on all kinds of things, get all kinds of personal attention, helping to try on sweaters and goggles and booties and things like that on their dogs, and all this personal service. And then when it came time to, well, should we wrap that up? They'd say, oh, no, I'm going to buy this online from Amazon. Mm. I could get it a lot cheaper. And, you know, and how does that make them feel? You know, they had been approached by Amazon and a couple of different companies that are actually out of business now and tried to get them to sell through them. Mm. And they had to take such a cut to be able to sell it that way that they never did go with that kind of service. They do deliveries and they do, you know, local deliveries, and they do mail service. You know, they you can buy online from them.
I gotcha, Susie. I want to bring Hart in on this now. So this idea, and we've heard this from a lot of stores, worried that customers come in, look at the products, get ideas, maybe get some service, and then buy it from Amazon. How can a store deal with that?
Yeah, that's a very good question. And this is particularly a problem for small retailers like the one Susie mentioned, but it's also a problem for bigger retailers, you know, like Target, for instance. You walk in, and, you know, while you're looking at the price on their shelves, you're also looking at the price on the identical item on Amazon. I think the key to it is that we cannot, as a retailer, whether small or big, we cannot expect that someone who looks at a specific item in our store does not go buy it online elsewhere. One has to take, you know, active charge of the situation. How do retailers do this? Well, you know, if you're a big retailer like Costco, the manufacturers make specific variants of the product for you. So the product is slightly different. If you want that exact product, you have to buy it from Costco or Costco online. You know, who's been successful at this? Kohl's has been successful at this, right? If you look at Kohl's clothing lineup, a large share of it are private labels. So that if you tried on that pair of pants and it fit you the right way, you can buy it at Kohl's or you could buy it at Kohl's online. Otherwise, you're not sure you're getting the same pair of pants. And so I don't think retailers should expect their customers who look at and get service to buy from them. They have to make it so they buy from them. And that means, you know, if you're selling the same product that's sold by 100 other retailers and by Amazon and by Walmart online, you have no chance. You need a unique selection that's unique to you, easiest to get from you, so that customers who walk out and say, yeah, I'll just buy it online, when they say that, you know that their only choice is to buy it from you.
Thanks for that call. We'll go to Jane now, calling from on the road. Jane, hi.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. Yeah, I work at a major box retailer. One of the effects I'm seeing from the pandemic is the impact on our elderly shoppers. And I think your guest could speak more to this, but our inventory is way down, way, way down. And we're not the only major retailer in that same circumstance. You go to all of them and you'll notice many fixtures have been taken out. Things are spread out. So when our elderly customers are coming in and trying to find things, we're sold out of their colors, their sizes. And they're unwilling to shop online. So there's going to be a major gap and struggle for them. They're unwilling to use apps. They're unwilling to sign on to online for their email. Many of them don't even have emails. So I see them really being left out in all this transition. Thanks for taking my call.
Jane, thanks for that call. Hart, two big things there. Is that something we're seeing, stores carrying smaller inventories, spreading out displays more? I hadn't heard about that.
Well, I have no data to bring to that question. I will say that when there are risks, like risks associated with the pandemic, that may at any time cause you, until recent to have to close your doors fully again in your brick and mortar location, it is natural and rational to think about how much inventory should I carry. But I think that the caller's broader point that the large box retailers are speaking to the mass, the center of the market. And one way to think about this is that the elderly, for instance, may be underserved. At the same time, if that's true, that's a window of opportunity for someone else to take advantage. So with every problem is someone else's opportunity, and maybe someone will come along who says, my target market is this segment. And tries to address it.
Thanks a lot for that call. Not time for more callers, but one of our callers on the line, Cheryl in Eau Claire, Hart, says she's seeing lots more rewards cards in stores, including restaurants. Now, is that one way to say, hey, you could buy this thing here or on Amazon, but hey, your local store, you're going to get these rewards. You get a benefit from actually buying it here. Is this an effective tactic?
It's an effective tactic going back to the airlines decades ago, grocery stores after that. But it's not just a tactic of offering Hart a discount if he buys, five pairs of jeans over the next year. It is also about collecting the data to connect it to particular consumers, to connect it to broader data sources that come from a variety of firms, so that they can target what they're doing to you more directly in their online offerings.
Hart, 30 seconds left. What is the big thing you're watching for over the rest of 2021?
Well, I think the big thing everyone is watching for is to see what share of customers come back to shopping in brick and mortar stores, and how it varies across segments of the economy and different businesses, fashion. Versus hardware versus other kinds of businesses. I think it's going to mostly come back, but we have to wait to see the data.
Hart, we'll leave it there. Thanks as always for joining us today.
Thank you for having me, Rob. It's always fun.
That's Hart Posen, professor of management and human resources at the UW School of Business and an expert on business strategy. He joined us today to talk about the future of in-person shopping and stores. Still time for you, by the way, to share your shopping story. What do you like to buy online? What kind of stores bring you back in the door? Let us know over on the Ideas Network Facebook page or email ideas@wpr.org. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, if you're looking for some fun stuff to do in Wisconsin in the last month of summer, help is on the way. Travel writer Gary Knowles is back with us for some great August getaways, and you can put in a plug for your favorites, if you're willing to share. And a new survey looks at American attitudes toward the U.S. Supreme Court and the big issues facing it in the coming year. We'll get the results of that survey, and you can share your thoughts, that and more, tomorrow on Central Time. Let's dip into the Central Time mailbag for a couple of responses to questions we asked you yesterday. One, I invited you to share words that you pronounced wrong for a long time, maybe because you read them before you heard them. My big one was saying ancient instead of ancient. Well, we heard from John on Twitter with a geographical example. He writes, after playing map-based board games with my sons, I welcomed and adopted my oldest son's pronunciation of Straits of Gibraltar as Straits of Gibraltar. I kind of like that. Gibraltar sounds like a science fiction planet or something. And we had a conversation yesterday about special holidays and celebrations of milestones, big and small in our lives, apart from the big annual holidays, birthdays, anniversaries, and so on. A colleague here at WPR mentioned an annual bike ride tied to the summer solstice. Cecilia emails, I too celebrate the summer solstice. I gather friends with kayaks on a backwater to the Wisconsin River. We pass around the book, The Wind in the Willows, each reading a section from the chapter, The Piper at the Gates of Dawn, which tells the magical story of a solstice night on the river with water rat and mole. Thanks for sharing that, Cecilia. Very fitting. Sounds like fun. I'll admit, I haven't read The Wind in the Willows. My band has covered three songs from the Pink Floyd album, Piper at the Gates of Dawn, and I had no idea that's where the album title came from. Always learning stuff. This is Central Time.